and our very special guest tonight, Andrew Bishago, as we talk about time travel. What an incredible story. Project Pegasus. And we'll be back with Andy and more on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Andrew Bishago is our special guest tonight. Andy, let's talk a little bit about the Philadelphia experiment. Of course, Al Bielek's been a guest on Coast to Coast. His brother was Duncan Cameron. Both of them feel as if they were jettisoned into the future. Did you learn anything about that during your situation?
I certainly did. One of the consulting engineers to Project Pegasus was the late Robert W. Beckwith. And when I was a child on Project Pegasus, he used to narrate his understanding of the event during World War II that has is now known to us as the Philadelphia Experiment. His facts held up 40 years later when he was interviewed twice by myself and then also by Alexander Bruce and by Ken Thomas of Steam Shovel Press. And the true story of the Philadelphia Experiment goes something like this. An event like the Philadelphia Experiment took place during World War II. But after the event, the Office of Naval Research had to script an alternate telling of what happened to de-link the critical connection between Tesla, teleportation, and the Los Alamos physicists who had built the atomic bomb. Because after Tesla's death in 1943, his papers were seized by the War Department and sent to Los Alamos, where the world's leading physicists were then gathering to build the atomic bomb. They're still there. I mean, my personal investigation of my experiences in Project Pegasus led me to detect that Tesla's papers are still there at LANL, and you require a special security clearance to be able to read them. Okay, so we have a Pegasus insider here who narrated the Philadelphia Experiment and his facts held up 40 years later. Essentially, the experiment itself was not intended to achieve radar invisibility of the Eldridge. That, in fact, was the cover story.
Right.
In reality, it was an attempt to apply Tesla teleportation to U.S. naval vessels after the Nazi Navy began chaining mines to the bottom of the ocean. It was hoped that they would find a way for our ships to move to the left or right, basically to avoid collision with Nazi mines. So the experiment was actually a direct experiment in teleportation. The ship was not the Eldridge, but in fact was another U.S. naval vessel called the Martha's Vineyard. And the experiment didn't take place in Philadelphia Naval Shipyard. It took place in Long Island Sound. The actual Philadelphia experiment was the attempt that was successfully made to tune in our experiment in Philadelphia with ordered liberty. That is to say, the tuning in of the signing of the U.S. Constitution, which I described on our last show.
Interesting.
Now, the relocation that occurred when they powered down the experiment did not move the Eldridge to Norfolk, Virginia, but the Martha's Vineyard to Newport News, Virginia. And there weren't numerous sailors fused in the hull of the vessel when they powered up the experiment and brought the ship back to Long Island Sound. In fact, according to Bob Beckwith, one sailor was falling through time-space, and when the ship was brought back to Long Island Sound, he was impaled through the chest by a pillar supporting the splash cowling of the captain's mast of the ship.
Oh, my.
Now, so something very dangerous and experimental took place that for which we now know as the Philadelphia Experiment. The critical fact they were concealing was that aboard the ship was not Tesla, not Albert Einstein, or John von Neumann, who have been featured in the various accounts of what's come down to us as the Philadelphia Experiment, but inside the Martha's Vineyard during that experiment were the Manhattan Project physicists J. Robert Oppenheimer and Edward Teller. And that's what they've been concealing, because they've always wanted to de-link this connection between Tesla teleportation and the Los Alamos physicists, because that became the U.S. time-space exploration program. So the Philadelphia experiment we talk about that Al Bielek has narrated with such great interest over the years essentially follows what happened, but it's more in the nature of an urban legend or a disinformation ploy to conceal the experiment that gave birth to the U.S. time-space exploration program.
Well, and that makes sense, Andy, because as we know, government has continued to try to mislead and hide things.
Exactly, and this is these were some of the most sensitive secrets that the U.S. government held at the end of World War II. They knew that teleportation would allow them to drop spies behind enemy lines, disguised as civilians. They knew that chronovision would give them the ability to view events going on across enemy lines, not just in real time, but in the past and future. So they were desperately concerned about concealing what happened during that experiment, because it was the first major experiment in Tesla teleportation.
If they have been telling future presidents about their candidacies and about their elections, they've got to have told the 2012 presidential candidate and president at the time then who he or she may be. You haven't heard any of that?
No, and let me explain why I can't play the role of a soothsayer and tell you, and that is, when I have been investigating my experiences in Project Pegasus, I've been an individual in his late 30s and 40s who's gone back and done a substantial amount of memory work to remember what was said in my presence, basically to go back and capture things that happened on a specific afternoon where let's say, Connie Chavez asked my father if they knew who President Jimmy Carter was when she read it in Alfred's book. So it wasn't as if I was briefed on everything that the future held. In fact, I've only been able, in the present, to go back and connect things that have since emerged with what I heard when I was a child on the project. So I can't predict who will be president in 2012.
Okay. And my point is, you haven't been told that by someone.
No, I certainly haven't been briefed recently. My knowledge of the way in which time travel technologies have, in a sense, undermined the constitutional protocols by which we select president, at least on the basis of giving the ultimate winner the winner's advantage of knowing that he's going to win on the day that he announces his candidacy, is based simply on these incidents that occurred both when I was on the project and later, in which I was able to link back from the present and say, well, wait a minute, is this the same Barack Obama I met in college? And so forth. I was never briefed on all of the presidents in the future.
Is Project Pegasus continuing?
I think it has to be. I know that there was an incident when we were on the project in which we were being teleported to Santa Fe in 1971, and when we arrived, we noticed we were in the right location, but that some of the landscaping around the Santa Fe State Capitol complex had changed. And as individuals working in the roundhouse were leaving at the end of the day, we asked them what year it was, and they told us it was 1991. So I know that teleportation was ongoing in 1991 because we were then transported down to Sandia and we jumped back to 1971 from 1991. So I know at least as of 1991, the project was still in possession of time travel technology.
As you know, Dr. Michio Kaku, physicist, has been on the program a lot. And you point out that he's been interviewed recently on C-SPAN talking about Project Pegasus, and he said it is fiction. Your thoughts?
Right. Well, certainly, just in prescript, let me say I regard Dr. Kaku as one of our most brilliant thinkers and philosophers. So I don't mean to disparage him in the slightest. I admire him very much.
Okay,
but there was another incident that occurred in college that allows me some insight into the empirical basis by which Dr. Kaku can evaluate whether or not the U.S. defense community developed time travel technology in the early 70s, as I've described it. And that was, I met Dr. Kaku in the early 1980s and spoke with him prior to a lecture he gave that was hosted by Dan Hirsch, the founder of the Committee to Bridge the Gap, which was a West Los Angeles anti-nuclear group. And during that 15 or 20-minute discussion, Dr. Kaku was describing for me how, as a result of quite conscientiously refusing to become involved in nuclear weapons development with Dr. Edward Teller, he was essentially ostracized from all defense work on behalf of the U.S. government. And so my position is that while Dr. Kaku has written some of the most brilliant treatises about the theory of time travel, he's not able to comment about the practical application of time travel because as a result of his idealism, he was barred from reading the Defense Department files in which the story of Project Pegasus and the emergence of these time travel technologies is articulated. And I think that's true of a number of other major figures in time travel at this time. They're prone to discount my account because their theory suggests that there's not enough theory even at this point to build time travel technologies. What I'm talking about, however, is the reduction of time travel technology to practice. And yet some of these individuals have been prevented from accessing the very Department of Defense records, which would show them the operation of the time travel technologies that exist. So the bottom line is you can't really speak authoritatively about the state of the art of a given technology if you're prevented from reading the scientific treatises and technical reports in which the state of the art of a given technology, such as time travel, is articulated.
Now, your father knew about this project. Did your mother?
No. In fact, we were trained quite brutally, in fact, almost trained in a Pavlovian way, basically, to be entirely refractory to the idea of ever telling anybody outside the project what we were involved in. We were admonished in a gentle way about this over and over again. Indeed, this subject was a major focus of the lecture that Donald Rumsfeld, the defense attaché to the project, gave to us in the spring of 1971 at the Cerrillos Cultural Center briefing room. We were basically admonished to never talk of the existence of the project to anybody who did not have a need to know. And so we were educated quite strenuously about not revealing to our mothers what was going on, our siblings, our classmates, our neighborhood playmates, or really anybody else in our life who was not involved in the program.
No, all right, but I thought you talked to the classmates. You gave a little 10-minute speech.
Well, that was when essentially my training was wearing down and I had already left the project. We had moved to California. I was coming up with a topic to talk about to my 7th grade honors English class, and I did talk about teleporting. But when I was in the throes of my project experiences, generally I wasn't revealing what was going on to anybody. And if my mother, for example, asked me a pointed question of explaining some anomaly, we were basically trained to give cover stories that would conceal our project activity. It was quite easy for them to conceal our project activities because some of the activities took place during the normal school day where we were bused to a local defense contractor location and, for example, involved in chronovisor probes to the past. A major part of our project activities resulted from teleporting to New Mexico and spending entire summers there and then teleporting back to the beginning of the summer on the East Coast. In fact, I spent 4 phantom summers in New Mexico, the summers of 1970, 71, 73, accessed from the fall of 71 and the summer of 1972, living in New Mexico with my father. So there was an extensive cover-up of our presence in New Mexico in this sort of quantum-displaced kind of way.
Now, when we were talking about going back to the past, you're saying that we were restricted because of technology. We could really only go back until the point where the technology was being developed. What about teleportation? Was that the same?
Well, teleportation was restricted because when you're teleporting, that's a form of physical time travel.
So that's only into the future?
Well, that was...
Or into the immediate, I guess.
Well, into the immediate past when the project already existed for return teleports to exist to get us back to the future, or into the distant past, or excuse me, into the distant future because teleportation is going to become a major part of the infrastructure, the everyday infrastructure in the future. So we were only able to physically teleport back to times before the, after the project had already emerged, and teleports existed to get us home to the present or far into the future. Now, the way, therefore, that they were using to get us to the distant past were forms of sort of physio-virtual time travel in which you're there as a spectral presence in that time and place, but not there entirely physically. And that's what Chronovision was achieving and a later technology called plasma confinement, which they were using to get me to Gettysburg in 1863.
And let's talk about Gettysburg. We've got this incredible photograph that you gave us. It's up there on the coasttocoastam.com website. Explain that and why Gettysburg? Why'd they send you back there?
Actually, it took place in the spring of 1972. I was taken to a time lab in East Hanover, New Jersey, under the direction of Dr. Sterling Colgate. Dr. Colgate was then serving as the president of New Mexico Tech, the New Mexico School of Science and Technology. And he had developed a methodology called plasma confinement, where the time traveler stands in a chamber, a clear lucite chamber, and walks into a cloud of plasma and is essentially wormholed to a past location. In fact, that was the only time that I was involved in actual wormholing, where as I was moving through the quantum plenum, I was moving through a series of arching tunnels that were sort of chaotic as I moved onto my destination. The reason that I was invited to go there was essentially as a reward for performing so well in the project. My father and Dr. Colgate asked me whether I wanted to go see Abraham Lincoln give the Gettysburg Address. They thought it was going to be a great thrill for me to do that. But in fact, I was thinking back to my history education in the program and also my conventional schooling and imagining that 1863 portrait of Abraham Lincoln by Alexander Gardner, where he looks basically like a chimpanzee in a black suit. And I was terrified by the notion of seeing Abraham Lincoln as he might appear during his life. It was sort of a Boo Radley moment in my childhood to even contemplate. So I actually begged off, and Dr. Colgate said, well, Ray, to my father, well, Ray, let's come back in 2 weeks and ask Andy whether he wants to go. So my dad drove me up again, up Ridgedale Avenue, up to the Time Lab in East Hanover, and they asked me the same question. And really, to please my dad, I said, sure, I'd like to go and go see the Gettysburg Address. So a woman named Valerie, I remember her first name, dressed me as a Union bugle boy. And I was invited to enter the plasma confinement chamber. Actually, before that, my dad took a pen, or pencil, rather, and he had a kind of a mimeograph of an 1863 map of Gettysburg. And he showed me that there was a north-south arterial through the heart of Gettysburg that in the northwest branched off on another road. And they were going to put me down via plasma confinement right on the side of that road so that I could ask a passerby which way Gettysburg was and then walk straight into town, into the very sort of minimal downtown that then existed where Lincoln was going to be giving the Gettysburg Address on a dais about 3 feet off the ground, yeah, right in front of the cemetery there. So I walked into the inside the chamber. I walked into the cloud of plasma under confinement, and I had this hellacious journey to Gettysburg where actually my hat was ripped off, both of my shoes, and one of my socks. Oh. And I popped into view next to that road northwest of Gettysburg. I could smell ozone. I was feverish. I was then reacting to the rather brisk autumn air, and I realized I only had one sock on. So my training took over, and I sat down, and I pulled off the other sock and threw it into the bushes because I figured if I'm going to be walking into Gettysburg barefoot, I should be entirely barefoot. So I then began walking without a hat. I didn't have a jacket. I was just dressed in the jersey of a Union bugle boy, no shoes. I met a gaunt teenage soldier, a Union soldier, walking along the side of the road, and I yelled to him, as my father had instructed me, "Hey, friend, which way Gettysburg?"
Just
and this
like
individual
that.
Stopped and squared his shoulders in the direction I was going and pointed that way. You're going in the right direction. So I spent about, I would say, 20 minutes walking past farmhouses and really utterly shivering in the cold autumn air. And I got into downtown Gettysburg, and I thought, I better find some warmer clothing here because I'm not going to be able to stand seeing Abraham Lincoln give the Gettysburg Address.
And how long are you supposed to be there?
I beg your pardon?
How long are you supposed to be there before they yank you back?
I was expecting to be there only long enough to see the Gettysburg Address. And the paradox of this, it really shows how advanced their time travel technologies were by this time. We're talking 1972. In some of these probes, certainly the chronovisor probes, I'm not certain about plasma confinement, they were actually able to see us where we were located in the quantum hologram. So I was anticipating there being there for several hours, but really just long enough to see the Gettysburg Address. So I walked down to downtown Gettysburg, and I went up on some of the wooden sidewalks that were in front of the downtown Gettysburg a storefront.
Let's pick up that story, Andy, when we come right back. And if you haven't seen the picture, it's up there at coasttocoastam.com under the highlight reel. So, Andy, there you are. You're little, you're shoeless, you're almost coatless, you're freezing, and you're walking into Gettysburg to see President Lincoln's address. What happens?
Well, I walked into downtown Gettysburg, which really didn't even resemble a downtown area. It was just really a cluster of buildings that looked like housing, with some of them with multiple stores occupying some of them. And I walked up onto the wooden sidewalk of one of them and looked into what we would call a millinery shop, which during the Civil War contained things like men's shoes and hats cravats and walking sticks and so forth, gloves. And as I was doing so, an elderly man gambled on up to the wooden sidewalk. He was about 70 years old, and he was limping severely on one of his legs. And he began yelling at me, "Boy, boy, what are you doing out here in the cold like this? You're going to catch your grip," which I take in the Civil War era must have meant catch a cold or a flu. And I've identified that man from historical photographs as a Gettysburg cobbler named John Lawrence Burns.
Huh.
John Burns was a citizen of Gettysburg. In fact, he was one of the first volunteers to the War of 1812 as a child. And when the Battle of Gettysburg swept through and past Gettysburg in July of 1863, he volunteered as a Union sharpshooter, was wounded in the hip, and was surrendered by Confederate forces under a flag of surrender back to the Union forces and was discharged from the battlefield. And so when I identified this man from historical photographs and realized it was the man who then took me inside the millinery shop to outfit me with a jacket and shoes because he was concerned about my well-being, I really found three things that were quite startling historical correspondences. One, of course, was his appearance. The other was his injury. I mean, before I even knew and had identified him as John Burns, I was describing how this 70-year-old man was limping severely as he walked up onto the wooden sidewalk. Mm-hmm. And then the other linkage that quite serendipitously identified without initially knowing who he was his profession. He was a Gettysburg cobbler. So he took me in the shop, and we went to the back of the main floor of the store. It just was basically had a kind of a storage room behind that one room floor space. And there was a shelf with multiple shelves that had used shoes on them. They weren't military boots. They were civilian shoes. And he took a pair of brown men's street shoes that must have been about a size 14. And he had me step into them, and he began actually shoving packing paper into the front of the shoes and was giving me this pair of secondhand shoes. He then took me into the storage room behind the shop and rummaged through a stack of about 40 men's jackets, most of them military issue, and outfitted me with a navy blue Union winter parka, which fit perfectly. And then as he was sort of smiling at me, he put a cap on my head. He then said, "Young man, I have to go. The President of the United States is arriving here today, and I have to see him." So he actually walked out of the shop limping severely ahead of me, and I followed him over to the dais where Lincoln was going to be soon arriving, walking along like a young boy, in his father's Sunday slippers. Like I could hardly even walk in these grossly oversized men's shoes. Now, over at the dais, which at that point only had maybe 10 or 15 people had already gathered, there was an open dais with nothing on top of it. It was just a big wooden area about, let's say, 20, I'd say maybe 15 or 20 feet deep and maybe 40 feet across with patriotic red, white, and blue bunting around it, but no parapet or ceiling of any kind or pillars or anything. It was just a flat expanse of wood. And I went to the front of the dais because I've been told that I was going to be given the opportunity to see Lincoln give the Gettysburg Address, and I was trying to overcome my fear of looking at him when he arrived. And I looked to my left, and there was my father dressed as a Pennsylvania farmer.
So he went back there too?
Well, he went back there, but he had left East Hanover on a previous day but had been sent to the same day in history, November 19th of 1863.
Was he looking for you?
At that time, no. He had been sent there earlier, so he couldn't have been briefed on my later arrival to the same day. And I looked over at him and said, "Dad, what are you doing here?" And he said, "I'm not your father, son. You must be mistaken."
Whoa. He played it that close to his
voice. Well, see, his training was kicking, and he was thinking, "Boy, if Andy's here, and he looks several years older than he does back at the house back in 1967 or when whatever he had been sent, I better act like I'm not even his father." So my dad, made sure that he didn't alert any of the people around him that, in fact, his son was there as well, recognizing him as being there, which is certainly a strange event. I was very disconcerted about this because here I'm in 1863 in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, being aware of the momentous event that is about to occur with President Lincoln giving his famous address there. And I thought, this is very disconcerting. So I walked away from my dad over to the left side of the dais. And there were two ladies, young ladies, dressed in their Sunday best, kind of gossiping at me behind their fans. They were sort of saying, well, look at this little carpetbagger. Look at the Union jacket he has on. And look at those men's shoes. They must have thought I was a carpetbagger who had collected my clothing off of the battlefield, because they couldn't have comprehended that I would have been given back by Mr. Burns.
And maybe an orphan or something.
Right, an orphan, maybe a deserter from a Union regiment. But they were certainly... they were certainly paying attention to me, and in my training, I had been coached to always avoid scrutiny, because scrutiny might result in becoming captive, and if we were captured, they might have difficulty extracting us from a location in the past or future. So again, my training kicked in, and I moved to another location on the more again to the center of the dais, the left corner of the dais, and there were two Union officers. And I was questioned by them about where my regiment was. And what my regiment was and where I was bivouacked. And I remember saying, you know, what's bivouac, sir? And they laughed hysterically. So here was more scrutiny that I realized I should avoid. So I thought, this is really strange. My dad's here. Some of the civilians of Gettysburg are noticing me. Now two Union officers who must be guards for President Lincoln have noticed my presence, and they're wondering why this Union bugle boy is there without his regiment, dressed sort of haphazardly at that.
Yeah.
So I decided, my training kicked in, and even though at that point I really sort of wanted to see Abraham Lincoln give the Gettysburg Address, I decided to walk about 200 paces on a diagonal away from the dais. And because I was, you know, walking along in these grossly oversized shoes, sort of like shuffling along, I wanted to conceal the size of the shoe so I wouldn't attract any more notice. So I held my left foot forward and my right foot to the side, and I looked in the opposite direction from the Wills Hotel, where Lincoln would soon be arriving. And it was in that strange posture, dressed in the clothing that John Lawrence Burns gave me, wearing grossly oversized men's shoes, as a time traveler from 1972 in DARPA's Project Pegasus, that I was photographed in the photograph that until last year was the sole surviving photograph to show President Lincoln at Gettysburg, on the day that he gave the address there. That's known as the Josephine Cobb image of Lincoln at Gettysburg.
How did you know that was you?
I knew it was me because as the project was winding down in 1971-72 timeframe, when we were still in New Jersey, had not yet moved to Southern California in November of 1972, I found that image in a contemporary news magazine. I don't know whether it was an old issue or a 1970, 71, 72 issue. I believe it was Life magazine. It may have been Look. It may have been the Sunday New York Times magazine supplement. But I was paging through a stack of magazines that a neighbor of ours had given to my mother, and my sister and I were out in the front stoop paging through these magazines, and I found that image. And I thought, my God, that's me at Gettysburg. There I am standing with my feet askew so nobody would notice the grossly oversized shoes. It must have been a Saturday or probably a Sunday, because I then took that magazine into the house. My dad was reading the paper, and I said, Dad, look, they got an image of me at Gettysburg. And he said, yep. I said, is that me? And he said, yep, but just don't talk about it. So from that point forward, I have lived with the awareness that the only photograph until, as I said, in 2008, I think it was, to show Lincoln at Gettysburg also contains an image of me as a time traveler from the future.
Was there some interest with Project Pegasus and the Civil War period? I mean, it seemed like they sent a lot of people there.
Yeah, actually, I had three encounters with the Civil War. The first chronovisor probe that I went to from the General Manufacturing Company facility in Convent Station, New Jersey, in fall of 1970, set me actually into a Civil War battle where I was overtaken by Confederate forces, and I was actually hiding beneath a berm, and Confederate soldiers were leaping over my location. And I was terrified that I might be bayoneted or something. But, of course, we couldn't be harmed during the chronovisor probes because we weren't there fully physically. So that was the first encounter with the Civil War. The second were the chronovisor probes in New Mexico in summer of 1971, where they kept on sending me back to the Lincoln assassination site to try to walk up the stairs and get into his balcony location to see who shot him, because, again, they were testing the existence of the multiverse. I guess they were wondering whether John Wilkes Booth shot him, or Major Rathbone, or perhaps Mrs. Lincoln. And so I was sent there four or five times, and slightly different things happened. But, of course, Ford's Theater was always there, and Abraham Lincoln ended up getting shot every time they sent me there. But, for example, I would walk through the lobby, maybe somebody would pass me at a different angle. Maybe a gentleman who'd been talking to a lady was actually talking to two ladies on another probe. So there were these slight changes in the scenario, but very minor ones. And each time, unfortunately, President Lincoln died there that night. The third, of course, was the trip to Gettysburg in spring of 1972. I don't think they were using time travel technology to scrutinize the Civil War. Okay. I think the explanation for this focus on the Civil War was basically that it provided an excellent background, an excellent time and place against which to experiment with time travel technology. For one thing, they had a 100-year accumulation of the works of major American historians describing the great battles and events during the Civil War. So they, when they sent us somewhere, they knew what was going to be occurring on that day in that location. And I think another reason they may have been focusing on the Civil War so much is that because they were utilizing children in at least a major part of their time travel experiments, they wanted to send us to a time when it would be normal for children to be by themselves, to be dislocated from their families, to be wandering the countryside,
good point.
To be involved in adult activities, for example, as Union bugle boys and drummers and so forth. So I think it was really germane to their goals in time travel experimentation rather than any particular interest that they had in the Civil War.
Did they tell you, Andy, not to get involved in, you know, messing up past events?
Absolutely. We received essentially a whole afternoon of lecture that essentially imparted to us the prime directive of Star Trek fame, of when they were sending us not to another planet, of course, but to another point in the time-space continuum. We were absolutely instructed to never pick up anything unnecessarily, never move something, never try to intervene necessarily to change an event, never to take anything back with us. We were there just to be observers and to essentially be able to report back to them what we saw in a particular point in time.
Remarkable story, truly.
So they were concerned about the butterfly effect and the thought that, well, you know, what if we told something to somebody that then resulted in discovery that altered the timeline in the future and so forth. We were there just to really observe and not interfere and make sure that there was really no alteration of the timeline beyond our presence there. But I must say that they found, as was discussed by the project administrator, when they shut down time travel to the past via chronovisor at the Sandia Auditorium in the middle of the first summer of 1971, and this is virtually a direct quote, he said, "Listen, gentlemen, every time we send the same child or a different child to the same past event, it changes, maybe a little bit, but it changes. And therefore, while we're gathering intelligence data about past events, it's not reliable because it's changing." So the very act of sending the same child or a different child to the same quote-unquote event was, I guess, as a result of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, changing that event a little bit.
Would you go back again? Do you miss that?
I don't really miss time traveling to the past. I think I would certainly probably teleport again, although that was sort of terrifying. I think if I had the opportunity to teleport, I would probably try to undertake an important mission, because it was stressful to go back and encounter a past time and then be extracted from that location and have to cope with my normal life again. I think if I was to go back in time again, it would be to approach Thomas Alva Edison in 1884, right before Nikola Tesla emigrated to this country. And I would urge Thomas Edison to view Nikola Tesla as a protege to be mentored and not as a competitor to be undermined. Because if there had been a better relationship between Edison and Tesla, I think we'd be living in a much better world today.
Edison could have helped him a lot.
He could have, certainly. And he was concerned. You know, he brought Tesla over when Tesla had solved an engineering problem that Edison had posted a $50,000 reward for. In fact, Edison actually welched on that reward and didn't financially remunerate Tesla. And Tesla had financial problems during the rest of his life. So when Westinghouse and Edison teamed up and sabotaged the career of Nikola Tesla, we really entered a more negative timeline than we would have if the works of Tesla had become dominant and had defined the 20th century in the way that I think they're going to define the 21st century.
If you could go forward into time, if you did this again, where would you go?
Boy, that's a tough one. I had an experience as a small child in my grandmother's house in Pennsylvania where an elderly man appeared on a sofa in an upstairs bedroom and looked over and smiled at me wistfully, and I think that may have actually been me in the future. So I think what I would do, because I had such a wonderful childhood growing up in such a remarkable, loving family, but also was given the cosmic privilege to participate in the early days of time-space exploration on behalf of the people of the United States, I think what I would probably do is go back to some ordinary memory in my childhood, maybe watch myself ice skating on a community pond or sitting in my third-grade classroom solving my times tables, or just some innocent moment when I was able to enjoy an ordinary childhood.
If you saw some calamity that was going to occur for you, let's say you were going to get hit by a car, not killed, obviously, because here you are, but something like that, would you have broken the rules to try to help yourself?
Well, I think that there's some misapprehension about how that actually works. When you go back in time, you're basically visiting yourself as an older version of yourself from the future. So you're actually a third party relative to your identity in the past. You don't merge with yourself in the past so that you're able to alter your alpha timeline and permanently change your present and future. Actually, what happens is when you go back and visit yourself in the past, you're somebody from the future visiting your alpha timeline, but then if you interfere with your destiny at that moment, basically, Schrodinger's cat takes over and a new timeline branches off. It's affected by your visit, but then you return to the future that you left. In other words, you don't sort of meld with yourself and change your destiny in real time. You're more or less visiting yourself, almost like a clone, sort of an identical twin separated in time. I've received a number of really heart-rending letters from people since I appeared on your show last November 11th, where people have literally begged me for information about time travel because they want to go back and protect a loved one who experienced an untimely death,
yes,
or let's say an accident that they had that affected their health. And I have to tell them that, look, when you go back and visit yourself in the past, you're imposing on yourself the bizarre experience of a visit from an older version of yourself, but you don't meld with yourself so that you can permanently change the outcomes of your existing life. You don't go back to a future that's changed by your intervention, unfortunately.
Andrew, when we come back, we're going to take phone calls with you, questions for Andrew Bashago, but also if you want to share stories with what would you do? What would you alter if you could go back into the past? Would you? We'll be back.